Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Durham Museum on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Gail Linz, New York Times best-selling author and award-winning writer of several international political novels, including The Book of Spies, The Last Spymaster, The Assassins, and her most recent novel, The Hunt for Dimitri. She'll speak on the topic, The Top Secrets of Storytelling, Creating Espionage Thrillers for the Masses. This program, presented as part of the recent Top Secret, License to Spy exhibit at the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 12, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Carrie Meyer, Director of Curatorial and Education Services at the Durham Museum.
Gail was born in Omaha, grew up in Council Bluffs, where she was editor of the Abraham Lincoln High School paper. At the University of Iowa, she was managing editor of the Daily Iowan and slipped into writer's workshop classes. Calming her desire to write fiction, she became a reporter for the Arizona Republic, where investigative journalism led to changes in state legislation. Her books have been People Magazine Page Turner of the Week and Beach Read of the Week, and are strongly recommended by Library Journal. With Robert Ludlum, she created the Covert One series, one of which, The Hades Factor, was a CBS miniseries. A member of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, she is co-founder and former co-president of the International Thriller Writers Incorporated. Please welcome Ms. Gail Linz.
How wonderful it is for me to be back and to see so many smiling faces. Thank you so much, Carrie. There you are. Thank you so much for your wonderful introductions. Readers, book lovers like you are important to me, and I'm so grateful to you. Here's an example. This is a true story. A few years ago, I was on a book tour and saw my latest hardcover on a very nice display in an airport bookstore. I was thrilled. I picked up the stack and I went inside. I've got all these books. I go inside. I put them on the counter in front of the sales lady. I take out my pen and I explain, I'm the author. And I offered to autograph the books. She looked horrified. This wasn't the welcome I'd hoped for. She explained that she really couldn't let me do that. No, no, I said. I really did write these, and I'd love to sign them for you. But by this time, a few other customers had heard, and they were gathering around. She looked at them, and then she looked at me. How do I know you wrote them? She asked. I took out my driver's license. This is the truth. And I showed her my name on the license and the name on the book. They were the same, Gail Linz. Really? You could be another Gail Linz. So I opened up the dust jacket of the book and I showed her my photo. See, it's me. I figured I had her at this point. Yeah. But instead, she looked me in the eye and she said, I can't let you deface the books. True story. Fortunately, I was saved. Someone in the crowd said, I'll buy it if she signs it. And that turned the tide. The crowd applauded. I tell you, readers, I signed the books. Other readers bought more, and I am forever grateful. You guys keep saving me. Thank you. I grew up loving books, and I grew up loving stories. My mother would come home on the bus from downtown with stories. Wherever she went, she'd listen to people, and she'd bring their stories home. She and my grandmother would sit at the kitchen table, drinking coffee and telling stories. Her girlfriends would drop in, Marguerite Dingman, Edith Schroeder, Maxine Meether, and Vernell Lainson, for example. And I'd be right there, never saying anything, just listening to them tell stories. That led to my reading everything I could get my hands on. Not just books, which I thrilled to, but also Campbell's soup can labels, candy wrappers, the newspaper, Life magazine. I love Life magazine. And even the cardboard roll inside toilet paper. I'm serious. I really did this. When I saw that there were words inside, I must have been putting the toilet roll back on the little doohickey. I saw there were words inside. So when the toilet roll was empty, I peeled the cardboard apart until I could read the words. Crown Zellerbach. And that's how I learned that Crown Zellerbach was the largest paper producer in the United States then. Now see what you can learn. Trivia. So I loved growing up in Council Bluffs and our trips to the big city, Omaha. I went to Hoover Elementary School, which I think several of you here did also, and Bloomer Junior High and Abraham Lincoln High School, and then off to the University of Iowa, where I got my degree in journalism. I used to sneak into the Writers' Workshop program because I just longed to write novels. It's what I really, really wanted to do. But honestly, I didn't think a kid from a little town in Iowa could ever grow up to realize such high aspirations. I'd never met or even heard a real live author speak. And there was a part of me that believed that authors were gods or goddesses. And if not, they were at least dead. So I became a newspaper reporter. I worked at a think tank then where I was an editor with top secret security clearance. Now, this was particularly important to me because it was my introduction to the intelligence community. I learned a great deal. I met a lot of people. I saw amazing things go in front of my, front of me on my desk that I worked on. And I was constantly intrigued by the power and what it meant. I married. I had two children. Then I stayed home to raise them. I baked cookies, and I loved every moment of it. I loved those years. But then I began writing short stories. After a while, I was told they were literary short stories. I didn't know what they were. And then they were actually published. The venue was literary journals, which was pretty cool. In some minds, even prestigious. But about the same time, I was going through a divorce, and I had to figure out a way to support my children. The journals didn't pay in money. They paid in copies of the journals. And paper is not a food group. So, here we go again. And so, over the next several years, I wrote fiction for money. All kinds of fiction. Male adventure novels and children's books. And everything was under pseudonyms. Finally, in the mid-90s, I was in a position to write a novel that could be published under my own name, my own book. This is what I had been dreaming of, hoping for, working for, but it was a big gamble. I had no literary agent, I had no editor or publisher, but I hungered to write my own books. In fact, by now, I hungered to write international political thrillers. And the reason I did was because I had been doing all this other work in which I could choose where to set the scenes. And I found myself writing about Paris and London and Rome and Bangladesh and South Africa. I was traveling around the world in the books that I was writing without my name on them, and I had all this other experience that was coming to me about the espionage world. So it just kind of clicked. Okay, I want to write spy novels. The result was Masquerade, which came out in 1996 and became a New York Times bestseller, and I felt very, very lucky and grateful to you readers. I'm often asked why I write spy novels, and my answer is always the same. How could I not? As J. Edgar Hoover said, there's something about a secret that's addicting. Secrets are powerful. They can be fun, they can be exciting, and they also can be dangerous. The bottom line is, once something becomes secret, it becomes important, and it has a power of its own. And the spies who keep the secrets and seek out other secrets are fascinating. You might remember Robert Gates. A few years before becoming Secretary of Defense, he was the Director of Central Intelligence. In other words, he was the head of the CIA. He explained it this way. When a spy smells flowers, he looks around for a coffin. Imagine the mindset. That's so evocative. It tells us a lot about how those in the espionage underworld think. So, let's push this a little bit further. What Hoover and Gates said explains a lot about their particular characters and the world that they came from. In fact, the basis of all great storytelling is the characters we authors choose and how we dramatize them, how we develop them. So, I'm going to give you a little example of this, and you're going to help me do it. You know that old awful joke about why did the chicken cross the road? That's the magic question. Now I'm going to ask you to help me. There's only four of these. Why did the chicken cross the road? Good job. Captain James T. Kirk of the Enterprise, to boldly go where no chicken has gone before. Number two. Why did the chicken cross the road? Bill Gates. I have just released eChicken 2017, which will not only cross roads, file your important documents, and balance your checkbook. It will lay eggs. And I use Windows, and I am telling you, the eggs. Oh. Number three. Why did the chicken cross the road? Sigmund Freud. The fact that you are at all concerned that the chicken crossed the road reveals your underlying sexual insecurity. Number four. Why did the chicken cross the road? Ernest Hemingway. To die. Isn't that fun? I mean, really. But doesn't it show you how the same question can be answered by different people? We would say different characters. And you learn a little bit how they think, how they feel, what's important to them, what their background is. So that's just sort of a short course in characters and characterization, what we writers call characterization. It's a sport in Washington to pick on the CIA. The CIA takes a lot of hits. And it's true, they make mistakes. They make big, bad mistakes. But what most people don't realize is that their successes are many. But they have to remain secret. Here's a success story that's only come out in the past few years. It involves Bill Casey. He was the director of the CIA under Ronald Reagan. There's always been tension in the CIA between those who believe risks have to be taken and those who are worried about taking any risks at all. It kind of sounds like real life, doesn't it? Casey wanted to get his people off the dime so they'd take more risks and he'd get better results because the results were abysmal. So he decided to find a way to inspire them. At the time, one of the CIA's Middle East stations had been trying to figure out how to put an eavesdropping device in the office of one of the country's senior officials. The official was very important, and his conversations could provide us with vital hard intelligence. But the officers in the station, in the CIA station, were arguing back and forth about whether they should take the risk, take the gamble. There are so many things that can go wrong when you plant a bug. You may have heard of the board game bureaucracy. The way it's played is, in bureaucracy, if you move, you lose. And this dithering was raising irresolution to an art form, and it got back to Casey. He was fed up. He reportedly said, and I'll clean up his language a bit, "I'll do it myself, damn it." You substitute other words there, you'll get the point. He was rather salty. It was completely against tradecraft practice to risk using a covert officer to plant a bug. And using the CIA director was a very serious violation, and he got a lot of flack, but he was not going to be stopped. So Casey had his people arrange a visit to the Middle East, an innocent visit, and to the country in question. No big deal. He flew over there, and while he was in country, he paid a courtesy visit to the government official they wanted to bug. There are two different versions of what Casey did and what happened. One account had it that he took a gift book to the official, and the listening device was built into the binding. Now, isn't that nice? I like the idea that the fellow was apparently a book lover. That's nice, right? The other version was that Casey sat down on the sofa, and when the official's back was turned, he jammed down into the cushion whack, a thin, miniaturized, long-stemmed microphone and transmitting device shaped like a large needle. That's a true story, by the way. He single-handedly gave new meaning to the cliché, pain in the butt. So, for years, I've been writing about spies because they can be a source of exciting adventures while at the same time, readers and I can dig into geopolitics, history, culture, and power. As I was working on my last book, The Book of Spies, I realized I never really focused on assassins, even though I write about them in every book. Then it occurred to me that most people think of assassins as monolithic, virtually identical. They're all psychopaths or sociopaths, and it's not true. With that, I was off, thinking and then writing about six fascinating characters from the old Cold War days. The novel is called The Assassin, and here are their backgrounds. Think about this. Mossad, Islamic Jihad. So you've got Jewish intelligence agency and Muslim intelligence agency. The old KGB, which is now, of course, the FSB and the SUV. La Cosa Nostra, in other words, the mafia. Basque ETA. And a Londoner from one of the old East End gangs. Those organizations are still in existence in one way or another. All were master assassins who survived the Cold War. There's a high attrition rate, as you can imagine, among assassins, which tells you how good these characters were at their work. Before the book opens, each character has left his background behind and gone independent. How each changed, grew, and yet carried his past with him became the basis of a large part of my new spy novel. And, of course, what I did with them was set them against each other. Who really was the best? Don't you love it when really highly expert people, great chess players, great tennis players go against each other because sparks fly. There's something magic about really, really people who are really, really good at what they do, even if they are contract killers. I wanted to know who was going to win. So, but at the same time, I needed a hero and a heroine because these guys they're not in charge of this book. All of my books explore the relationships that those in intelligence have among themselves and with civilians. Do you know this? I'm sure you know the TV series called The Americans. It's such a big box office hit and has done very well. The Americans. And what it's done in revealing the inner workings of undercover KGB spies is what I try to do in my books with other kinds of spies. People who work in intelligence tend to marry each other because it just makes life easier. They fall in love because they work together, they know each other, and then life just gets easier because they understand when the other can't talk about something or when he or she needs to leave unexpectedly. At the same time, their children often go into the work too. Just as there are families of plumbers and lawyers and school teachers and mafiosa, there are families of spies. For instance, the CIA's greatest traitor, Aldrich Ames, was the son of a CIA officer, which most people don't know. So, in The Assassins, I created a growing relationship between a retired military intelligence officer named Judd Ryder and a former museum curator named Eva Blake, who's just joined the CIA and is in training at the farm. So, Judd wants out of the life. He's done it. He's over it. He's done Iraq. He's done Afghanistan. He's done an awful lot of work. He's tired. He doesn't want to do this anymore. He's in his early 30s. He wants a new life. At the same time, Eva wants into the life. And she's absolutely dedicated to her training, and she's good at it. She's got a talent, and she wants to make a contribution. This is important to her. So we have this conflict between the two of them. Their story is the thread that weaves throughout the book as they address each of the six assassins. So we watch their interplay and their growing relationship and how they figure out how they can or can't be together. And there's always a happy ending in my books. I didn't say that. There's not always a happy ending politically because most political situations are not easily resolved in one book. At the same time, I like to write about history and how that plays into today's world. As an example, I'm going to read just the opening of The Assassins. Now, this is why I'm reading it, because everything in it is factually accurate, except for the last paragraph. And that's fiction. This takes place in the past, and the rest of the book is contemporary. Night gave Baghdad little relief. Electricity was fitful. Garbage rotted along the boulevards, and clean running water was a memory. Gunfire crackled across rooftops as looters carried off computers, chairs, and crates of canned goods. Since the invasion, there was no more dictator and no more law. In earlier, better times, the country was known as Mesopotamia, a rich land where the wheel and writing were invented. It was all documented in the National Museum of Iraq, which contained priceless antiquities dating back 100,000 years. Imagine that. International law forbade anyone to use cultural sites for military purposes or to attack them. But the museum was strategically located on 11 acres in the heart of Baghdad, protected by a tall security wall and dotted with towering turrets perfect for snipers. So the Iraqi Republican Guard took it over. And when the American soldiers invaded, the guards blasted them with machine guns and AK-47s. The Americans fired back, and they kept coming. Finally, the guards brought out their biggest guns, a rocket-propelled grenade RPG, and sent a firestorm down on us. A U.S. tank responded with a single round from its nosebleed 120-millimeter main gun, taking out the RPG position but leaving a gaping hole in the facade over one of the museum's reconstructed Assyrian gates. I mean, it was enormous. Under the laws of war, the Americans were entitled to defend themselves, but they had also seen how easily they could destroy the museum. So the task force commander ordered the tanks to remain in the intersection in front of the museum, but out of range of the Iraqis, and they saved the museum. And here's the last paragraph. This was the tense situation near midnight on April 10th, 2003, when six international assassins made their way individually through Baghdad's back streets toward the museum. They were in Baghdad because Saddam Hussein owed them money. And when the Americans won the war, his wealth would be confiscated. This was their last chance to get what was theirs. So, here's another historical note that plays an important role in the novel. When Saddam rose to power in Iraq in the late 1970s, he turned the country into his personal piggy bank. I think we all know he took bribes and kickbacks from government enterprises and private companies and individuals. Eventually, he got to worrying that too many people knew about this money and where it was. So this is where my fiction comes in. I imagined that Saddam secretly brought in six financial advisors to distribute his money around the world in secret accounts. Then he hired my six assassins to eliminate the financial advisors, meaning he was the only one alive who knew where his wealth was hidden. You'll notice the assassins are furious at Saddam. That's because he stiffed them for the second half of the money he owed them. In real life, Saddam was notorious for not paying his bills. No surprise there, huh? Here's another interesting fact and one of the bits of information that inspired me to write the book. In real life, when the United States captured Saddam in December 2003, his wealth, that hidden wealth, was estimated to be between $40 and $70 billion. The expectation was we'd find his fortune and we'd use it to pay for the war and for rebuilding Iraq. The truth was, we were able to track down only a few billion dollars, and we are still searching. Other governments, organizations, and individuals are looking too. The search for Saddam's billions has turned into the biggest and the quietest treasure hunt the world has ever seen. One of the reasons I love this book is the amount of actual political and intelligence events that are woven through it. By following Judd and Eva, we investigate the assassins, uncover a political powder keg, and eventually find Saddam's hidden billions. I couldn't resist. Someone had to figure out where he hid all that loot. It may be a lie, but at least I felt a little satisfaction. In closing, I'd like to share a quote I love from Christopher Marley, another author. When you give someone a book, you don't give them just paper, ink, and glue. You give them the possibility of a whole new life. See, that's our job as fiction writers, to give you the experience of other places, other lives, and it can be a lot of fun. So that's a short course in how we spy writers do it. We find actual people and situations, and then we entwine them. We pit them against each other, and we wrap them in a ribbon of adventure. We have fun, and we hope you do too. Thank you. I don't know where my microphone is. I'd be real happy to take any questions if you guys have any for me. I've answered all your questions in advance, haven't I?
I've got a question for you. After leaving the high school, I went into the Air Force. 1 year later, I had a top secret PSYOP clearance, working in a heavy bomb wing of B-52s, planning missions into Russia. Then I went to Vietnam and spent 11 months in two covert operations, both of them highly top secret, one in the North Vietnam and one in the Laos, the secret war. Then I spent 29 years on the fire department as a captain in hazmat and paramedic. At the end of my career in the Air Force, I decided to write a book. And as I sent the information out to these publishers, they came back and said, well, you didn't have any formal education in creative writing. I said, wait a minute, I actually did this stuff. I'm not somebody sitting in some college in a seat learning how to go to a creative writing class. I experienced this. And I still have reunions with people who did this, like the Raven Facts and the Covey Facts. How does a person who has all this experience, and I know that Tom Clancy had to self-publish his first book, The Hunt for Red October, he said, make sure that your fiction is factual, all your points are factual, connected with a fiction line. How does a person who has all this experience, such as I have, tries to put it into writing and then have these publishers look at you like you're some bumpkin that doesn't have an education and doesn't know how to write? I mean, how do you do that? You said you went to college and became a journalist. I was not getting a journalist. I was getting shot at the time instead of going to college. But what I learned you could never learn in a college classroom. So how does a person get beyond that door that the publishers throw at you when they find out that you've never been to college or taken a creative writing class?
Thank you so much for your service, first of all, because that, thank you. It's very frustrating for you and for others. And it is, we don't want to lose our history. And what you're talking about is history that you lived. Just as there are people, you have experiences that most people in this room will never have. And obviously you were very, very good at what you did. What happens in the writing, the art of writing, the business of writing, however you want to call it, is that many of us spend 20 years learning to do that. And there are, you know, it's like you go to a surgeon and he charges you $500 to you know, stick a needle in your knee. And you say, why am I paying $500? What you're doing is you're paying for 40 years of education that's taught him what size needle, what to put in your knee, what is exactly wrong with your knee, on and on and on. So I personally would like to see your story turned into a book that's published. I think that you have perhaps already considered and discarded the idea of going to creative writing classes to get some help. Honestly, I think you would benefit from someone who is a good writer, who would work with you and help you to get on paper in a way that gives the experience to the reader. And go ahead, you want to say something?
I did join a writer's guild here in Nebraska. And one of the first things they told me is never start a novel with the person in it having a dream. Well, come on now. Vietnam vets have lots of PST, and that's what it is. And I got discouraged. I actually got discouraged going to this guild because they would shoot you down because they said, well, you're not telling it right. I was telling it like we lived it on the ground.
Okay, I haven't seen your work, so I can't, you know, make a real comment about that. I don't know the Writers Guild because I'm no longer around here. I don't know who they are. I do know that I teach writing here and there, and I'm always very careful about this because what I do is I encourage people to find other, I encourage writers who are unpublished to find other writers who are at the same level, and you can grow together. I still suggest City College writing classes. Look, I was told at a night class that I couldn't write, I would never publish. There are always going to be people out there who tell you can't do something. With my first book, the publisher, the head of a Dutton, wanted to buy my book. She called my agent. She was given a preempt. She could make the offer before anybody else got to see it. That's this masquerade. And she said, I love this book. I want to buy it. I can make it into a New York Times bestseller, but no woman could have written it. Now, what do you expect me to do? I could Xerox my body. I mean, this is insanity. So you're running into something like that. So, look, you are obviously a man of many parts. You don't quit. You have a story to tell. You have been discouraged by people who probably don't know what they're talking about. But there are people out there who do know. And I'm not from this area, so I can't help you that way. But I do suggest night classes, two-day weekend conferences. Take your stuff. Read it. Get other people's feedback. And realize that you're an intelligent man, and you will know when something actually might be helpful. But other than that, I can't say because, you know, the publishing world is populated by extremely intelligent, wonderful, kind people, and there are always some idiots. Yes, yes, over there.
What was it like to be a woman breaking into a field which was dominated by men authors?
You realize I didn't set him up to that. I married him. I think men are cute. It was challenging. It's funny because my experience was a lot of the prejudice. You know, it's a male-dominated field. A lot of the prejudice mostly came from women rather than men. It was real interesting. But my readership is about 50% men and 50% women, which I love. Yes.
I'm wondering about your association with Robert Ludlum. How did that begin?
Oh, that was so much fun. This was very early in my career. I think I'd published two novels, and I was being called the female Robert Ludlum. And he had jumped publishers and wanted a fresh start in several ways. And one of the fresh starts was he wanted to actually create a series for the first time on purpose. The Bourne series was an inadvertent series. I have a couple of inadvertent series, too. So they came to me and asked if I would be willing to do this. And I had admired his work a lot, particularly the first six books. There was real genius in a lot of the things that he was doing in those books. And I thought the opportunity to work with him was pretty cool. So I did say yes. I was at that point making more money on my own books than they offered me. But I was doing it because I was going to be able to work with an icon. And then tragedy struck. I knew he'd been ill. I didn't realize how ill. He passed away. So I was never able to work with him. But the books are good. They're solid, and I'm proud of them. Anyone else? Yes, in the yellow shirt.
You had mentioned that you had written under or using a pseudonym when you first started. Why did you use those? And then did you ever use a man's pen name? Or were they all female or both or what?
Good question. I was doing what was called work for hire, where publishers bring in writers that they think are suitable for a series, and we write under the house name. One of those was Nick Carter. Nick Carter was like America's answer to 007. And this was, of course, instrumental in giving me the opportunity to write about places around the world. And for me, it was like getting a master's degree in creative writing. I could experiment. I did everything. I played around with character, with mood, tone, description. I could even do multiple viewpoint. And they paid me. So I thought that was pretty cool. I also wrote in the Three Investigators series, the Alfred Hitchcock Three Investigators series. I thought I would be able to write that series under my own name, but my editor frankly said, no, boys will not buy books by girls. Now, this was 20 years ago, and I don't think that's true at all now, but that's the way it was in the dark ages. So there was that. I just did a lot of different series where I didn't own the name, and I was not going to get, except for the Three Investigators, I wasn't going to get royalties. But it, for me, it was an education. You know, here I am doing literary short stories, and then I'm doing adventure novels. I mean, what's better than that? I get the whole gamut. Why not bring them together? Anything else?
What would you say your biggest challenge as a writer is?
The biggest challenge to a writer? I think it's belief in oneself, because as the gentleman up there was saying, it's a hard business. When I started out, there were close to 100,000 books published a year. Now there are 1 million. And if you go into a library, and I hope it's a well-stocked library, I'm a big supporter of libraries. You go into a bookstore, and I hope it's a well-stocked bookstore, and you stand there, and you look around, and you know that a lot of those books are really good. People get discouraged. They say, what can I say that's new? What if I work for 2 years on a book, and I can't sell it? Nobody wants to publish it. Well, now there are other things they can do. They can go, they can self-publish on Amazon or one of the other e-book programs. So I think discouragement, the sense that what is the point, gets to a lot. It's interesting, when I think back to the people that I've taught over the years, because I only taught adults, often the ones who had the greatest talent were the ones that fell by the wayside. And I'm not quite sure why that was, but there was something else that was missing, some kind of persistence, some kind of hunger. I think when you fall in love with books the way I did, where they helped me make sense of the world, and they allowed me to travel the world, they allowed me to live other lives, so that became important to me. So I would say to people who are beginning to write or thinking about writing is, don't quit. Write for yourself. Not everybody has to be published. It's really important to get these things down on paper. It really is. And you can, if you get it down on paper, it's there for posterity. It's there for your family. It's there for posterity. The chances of it being lost are lessened a great deal. Just because I publish doesn't mean everybody else has to. There's the joy of writing. Anything else?
I was watching C-SPAN this weekend and the interview with Hillary Clinton, and she mentioned that she was starting to see more independent bookstores. Are you finding that to be true, and that the big box bookstores are kind of going out of favor as opposed to more independents?
Yeah, that's been a huge transition in our industry. As you know, Borders closed a few years ago, and that was a big blow, and then Barnes & Noble divested of I don't know how many bookstores, of lots and lots and lots. So where are all those books going? They're going into the trash. Some of them will be resold at cut rates, but the publishers were very badly hurt by that. And a large part of it did come because of Amazon. On the other hand, Amazon has enabled so many people to read who had not read before. So it's a mixed blessing. What's happening now is, yes, we are seeing more and more independents. And boy, they were half dead 10 years ago. We are seeing more of them. And I just read in Publishers Weekly that Barnes & Noble is starting to talk about opening more stores again. I think what's happening is that there is a huge shift. The the novelty of e-books is wearing off, and I see a lot of people here who are my age. It's hard for us to give up print. And now the kids who are coming along are so inundated with everything they have to do online, they like a book in their hands. So nothing is static in this world, and change does not mean progress. But we are going through changes, and I think in this case, a lot of it is progress.
On your last book, it became audio. Do you get to choose who reads your books?
I've never been asked. I have been so fortunate in the quality of the people who have done it that I have never asked. The audio companies that buy me, they try to match me with readers who they believe will best bring the stories to life, and I've been very happy with what they've done. Yes, a couple over there.
Do you travel to the foreign countries to do research for areas where you're talking about foreign areas like Rome you mentioned and so on?
I do travel when I'm writing about foreign countries. And some of them I get to and others I don't. So this is one of the fun things that I do is I never tell people where I've actually gone because I find, with luck, most people can't tell. when I research a place, believe me, I research a place. I talk to people who have been there. I read everything I can get my hands on. And by the time I'm finished, I feel as if I have been there. I'm usually dreaming about it. But yes, I do love to travel, although I must say less nowadays because of all the airplane things. Those seats are so narrow. And there was another lady over here. I can't quite see.
Do you have a set period of time that you set aside to write every day? And then do you ever have to force yourself to complete a project?
Oh, you're asking about my routine. Yes. Oh, Lord. I don't have a routine. I'm one of those writers who is an immersion writer. I'm in awe of people who set... this is a wonderful story. Ross, do you remember Ross McDonald and Maggie Millar, two great mystery writers? And they had a deal. They were married, of course. And one of them wrote in the morning for 4 hours, and that was sacrosanct. Nobody bothered them. The spouse was there to protect them. And the afternoon, it was 4 hours for the other spouse. And the story is that one day Maggie had a flat, but it was his time to write. So she sat in the car and waited until his time was up before she called for help. That just blows my mind. Yeah. they had one kid, and their lives were much more simple. But John and I we all have our own biologicals, and we have a whole passel of stepchildren. We have a very big family. They're very important to us. A lot of times they come before the work, which is the way it should be. So I'm an immersion writer. I prefer to do nothing but write when I write, which means I go through days, and that's all I do. And don't phone me. I don't want to answer email. I don't want to talk to anybody. It's because I usually can't, because I'm just living this other life. But everybody develops their own style. It's one of the most important things you will do as a writer, is figuring out what works for you. How do you get ideas? Some people go take hot showers. They find that that works. Other people take walks. Some people, this is the Edison story about the hypnagogic state. He would lie, when he was stuck, he would lie on the chaise that was in his office, and he would put ball bearings in his hand and rest his arm off the side, and he would close his eyes and go into the hypnagogic state to try to solve the problem, because you know what creativity is. It's just solving a series of problems. And if he fell asleep, his hand would drop, the ball bearings would hit the floor, create a racket. He'd wake up. Oh, I didn't want to fall asleep. He'd pick him up, put him back in his hand, and go back into the hypnagogic state to return to trying to solve the problem. Isn't that a wonderful story? Edison was pretty cool. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Durham Museum on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Gail Linz, New York Times best-selling author and award-winning writer of several international political novels, including The Book of Spies, The Last Spymaster, The Assassins, and her most recent novel, The Hunt for Dmitri. She spoke on the topic, The Top Secrets of Storytelling, Creating Espionage Thrillers for the Masses. This program, presented as part of the recent Top Secret, License to Spy exhibit at the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 12, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.